not only has Starbucks been firing vocal union leaders like the Memphis Seven, like Layla in Arizona, like Kessie Fleischer and others in Buffalo, but they've been slashing hours across the country to try to purge everyone and force everyone to quit or have to get other jobs, and then telling them, oh, suddenly your availability doesn't meet the needs of the business. If we, the only... this is all showing just how much we need a union, because, you know, together we can fight back against all of these things.
Yes, Brzezak, we want to thank you for being with us. Barista at the Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York, the first location in the U.S. to unionize with Starbucks Workers United. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Anna Osbeck, Maria Inez Terracena, Mary Conlin, and David Prude. We have a job opening for a news writer-producer. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics.
First, I want to introduce to you Pierre Labossiere. Pierre Labossiere is the co-founder of the Haiti Action Committee. He is a longtime national and international activist, and he will welcome us to today's program, Haiti at the Crossroads, Rebuilding Popular Democracy.
Thank you for attending this very important webinar, Haiti at the Crossroads. And as Walter mentioned, you'll be hearing it's very important at this stage of the struggle in Haiti for us to be together and to think about how best we can help the movement of our sisters and brothers in Haiti for justice. This is the 30th anniversary, the 30th year anniversary of the Haiti Action Committee when we were formed in 1992. The people of Haiti and we, the Haiti Action Committee, totally support the people's movement, as the people's movement has time and time again showed very significantly that they recognize the leadership of Fanmi Lavalas as a true representative of the Haitian people. Not only did Fanmi Lavalas present a coherent program for the development of the country, but they have been voted every time there is election, free, fair, democratic elections in Haiti. Fanmi Lavalas has been voted overwhelmingly and massively into office. And while in office, they have built the institutions. They have built up democratic institutions. They have built structures and infrastructures in the country to improve the lives of the people of our country. And so that's why the population is very much united behind Fanmi Lavalas and deeply respects it. And so I wanted to make that very clear on the outset. And this is the reason why the Haiti Action Committee supports the grassroots movement of Haiti and also their support for the leadership of Fanmi Lavalas in trying to build a better Haiti for the population. But as Fanmi Lavalas also says, it takes all of us to be part of it, all Haitians of goodwill. And you can be members of different political organizations, but as long as you're building for Haiti to be sovereign and for Haiti to be recognized, then, you know, it's a big family that we have to be part of. So I want to thank you again for your support and your solidarity with the Haitian people. And we want to bring hope that this webinar will bring some clarity that we need to move forward in this current period. Thank you very much and welcome.
We're going to be hearing now from Leslie Mullen, You may see at times Leslie's articles in the Journal of the Haitian Action Committee. Leslie Mullen is a longtime anti-imperialist activist, a political prisoner and a former political prisoner, and a member of the Haiti Action Committee. Leslie, welcome.
Thank you so much, Walter. Everyone with us today will remember the scenes from the Del Rio refugee camp that horrified the world when mounted U.S. border police charged Haitian refugees and used their reins as whips to terrorize Haitians away from the U.S. border. And the cruel images that unmasked the U.S. government's racist disregard and contempt for the people of Haiti, for Black Haitian lives. But Del Rio has now faded from the headlines, and actually the Biden administration has only doubled down on sending Haitian refugees back to a country that its own State Department has designated the highest travel risk, a country that the U.S. recognized was undergoing a deteriorating political crisis, violence, and the staggering increase in human rights abuses even before the assassination of Jovenel Moise, Haiti's U.S.-backed dictator, and before the August earthquake. Last February, at the start of Black History Month, ICE began using what's known as Title 42 to drastically escalate the expulsion of Haitian refugees. Title 42 grew out of the Trump White House effort to close off the southern U.S. border, using the pandemic as a pretext to stop refugees from entering the United States. It's often called Trump's invisible wall. Under Title 42, the United States has effectively eliminated the right to asylum in violation of U.S. and international law. Any border agent can expel a refugee without the opportunity to apply for asylum. Hundreds, thousands of people are being denied the right to seek protection, not just Haitians, but refugees from around the world. Since September, over 17,000 Haitians, I think it's up to 19,000 now, have been forcibly returned to Haiti. In one recent month, 49 chartered flights left the United States filled with Haitian refugees. They're often chained and shackled without food and water, and they are dropped off at Toussaint Louverture Airport with nothing. And some of them are women 35 and 36 weeks pregnant. On another front of global U.S. policing, in collaboration with countries like the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and the Bahamas, the U.S. Coast Guard extends its armed patrols far into the Caribbean, hunting down and returning Haitians before they ever get near U.S. borders. This week, the Coast Guard intercepted 88 Haitians near the Bahamas and returned them to Haiti. Another 191 Haitians were intercepted in the southern Bahamas. But we can't talk about this country's indefensible treatment of Haitian refugees without addressing the role our government plays in creating the circumstances that drive people to flee. 18 years of U.S. intervention after the 2004 U.S.-backed coup overthrew Haiti's democratic government, headed by President Aristide, have brought only misery, insecurity, and violence to Haiti. The 2010 earthquake that killed over 200,000 people took place under a U.S. United Nations occupation. The immediate U.S. response to the earthquake was a heightened military presence in and around Haiti because the Obama administration feared an exodus of refugees. A democratic Haitian government that valued Black lives would have begun to repair Haiti, restore infrastructure, housing, sanitation, education, healthcare, food security, all efforts that the Aristide government was undertaking before the coup. Instead, the U.S. launched the infamous Bush-Obama-Clinton Build Back Better plan, an undisguised global corporate NGO grab bag to plunder Haiti's resources and make a profit. Since then, the United States has steadfastly backed a series of corrupt and brutal regimes. The ruling party there is called PHTK, means bald heads. Government-affiliated death squads have paralyzed Haiti with the worst kidnapping wave in history. Death squad violence targets grassroots communities for their political resistance. People are now literally unable to leave their homes for fear of being kidnapped, raped, or murdered. Nowhere is safe. Thousands of people have been and are being killed, including many journalists. And we need to unpack the racism of the mainstream media that talks about Haiti as if these things are somehow endemic to Haiti or to a failed state or to African people in general. And they rarely make the connection between the horrific conditions facing Haitians and the US orchestrated policies that have created them. A lot of times what we know of refugees comes from images of thousands of people massed at the US border. We don't know who they are as human beings. But here is one story of one Haitian man who's currently in US custody. He and his family owned a plot of land in Haiti where they planned to build a home. But the local agents of the PHTK ruling party came to take away the land. And when the man and his family resisted, the man's father was shot and killed. And eventually this man, the son, fled to the United States. But his wife remained in Haiti to take care of a business that she had. So agents returned to seize the land. And when the wife, who was 6 months pregnant, stood up to them, she too was killed. And now this man, bereft of his family, waits in an ICE facility in the southern United States, hoping that the United States will recognize his claim to asylum. After Haiti's 2010 earthquake, Brazil became a main destination for Haitians leaving their country, recruited with the promise of construction jobs as Brazil got ready for the World Cup and for the Olympics. But later, Haitians found themselves disposable and no longer welcome. And by the thousands, many left Brazil for Chile, and as conditions became even more deplorable there, the United States. Only the most desperate, determined, and courageous people would choose to make the 7,000-mile journey through Latin America to the United States. About 60% of those who are undertaking the treacherous Darien Gap through Central America are Haitian men, women, some pregnant, some single moms, children, and infants who are facing extreme danger and arduous conditions. Heat, exhaustion, hunger, robbery, rape, to reach the United States. And Del Rio showed us what awaits them if they make it. The US border industry maintains secret detention centers across this country designed to deny people access to the outside world, to their families, to attorneys, to interpreters, to the media. Haitian refugees in US custody are being confined in freezing crowded cells without adequate food or water, without sanitation or basic medical care, and without knowing why or for how long. But it's important to understand this is not new, as Cafanol told us about. For over half a century, the United States has backed brutal Haitian dictators while at the same time expelling Haitian refugees back to the dangers they have fled. The first boat carrying Haitians fleeing Duvalier arrived in the United States in the 1960s, and they were all deported. From the 70s through the 80s, still under US-backed Duvalier dictatorships, the United States continued to expedite the swift removal of Haitian refugees. After the 1991 military coup that overthrew Haiti's first democratic government headed by President Aristide, thousands of his supporters were hunted down and killed by the military junta. The number of Haitian refugees fleeing repression rose dramatically. The Coast Guard captured and forcibly repatriated many thousands and imprisoned up to 21,000 Haitians at a time in Guantanamo Bay. This outrage sparked massive worldwide protests. Within the United States, a vibrant movement of Haitian diaspora, prominent Black activists and artists, college students, churches, human rights, labor, and anti-imperialist activists emerged. In 1992, dance artist Catherine Dunham undertook a 47-day hunger strike at the age of 82 to protest the policy of repatriating Haitian refugees into the arms of the ruthless military junta. Tennis champion Arthur Ashe was arrested in front of the White House along with leading Black activists at a protest of Bush immigration policy towards Haitians organized by Trans Africa and the NAACP. 2 years later, Trans Africa Forum Director Randall Robinson fasted nearly a month to protest the Clinton administration's policy of returning refugees to Haiti without hearings on asylum. Haiti Action Committee grew out of this movement. One memorable action 30 years ago happened when Haiti Action, the Bay Area Peace Navy, ACT UP, Global Exchange, and others planned a protest U.S. unjust and racialized policy towards Haitian refugees with a public dramatization of our solidarity. What happened was this. The Peace Navy launched three boats across the San Francisco Bay from Berkeley towards San Francisco, filled with dozens of enthusiastic Haitian community members, some of whom were former refugees. Meanwhile, at the San Francisco Pier, over 150 demonstrators were waiting to welcome these symbolic Haitian boat people. Even board of supervisors from the city were there to greet them and present flowers. Well, to everyone's surprise, the Coast Guard got wind of this action, and they were afraid that San Francisco was really under threat for an influx of Haitian refugees. So they had helicopters circling overhead, and they intercepted and boarded the boats to check everyone's papers. Meanwhile, on the wharf, passersby who were watching this began chanting, "Let them land, let them land." It made headlines, and it made for really great street theater. And it reminds us we can never underestimate the crucial role of activism. The world we live in is different now, but the issue of refugee rights has never been more urgent, not only for Haitians, but for displaced people around the world from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, to Syria and Yemen, Iraq, the Sudan, and more. Consistent advocacy work for Haitian refugees is underway right now among Haitian and Black activists, community organizations, churches, refugee rights and grassroots organizations. As solidarity and anti-racist activists, we embrace this work and we join in the demand to stop the deportations. No one is illegal. We stand with Haitian and all refugees. And we hold the U.S. government accountable for its criminal, inhumane violations of refugee rights, and we demand an end to U.S. intervention in Haiti.
Leslie, thank you so much. If you want more information, go to the website. That's HaitiSolidarity.net. We're going to move next to hear from Margaret Prescott. Margaret Prescott is an activist, author, journalist, and radio host. She is with the Global Women's Strike Working Group on Haiti. She is presently the host and executive producer of the Sojourner Truth radio program, which is broadcast by KPFK and syndicated by Pacifica radio stations WPFW in Washington, D.C., and WBAI in New York City. Margaret, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Walter. Thank you so very much to be with you all. And I'll have to say, it was really a pleasure, Leslie, to hear about the history of Haiti Action Committee and standing with Pierre Labossière and all of the members of Haiti Action Committee. Congratulations for 30 years of just incredible work and incredible activism. And Pierre, who is always very humble, just lifting him up, because for those of us in the Global Women's Strike Working Group on Haiti, he's very much a point of reference for the work that we're doing. And we know that he lifts up Franz Kafinal and so many others that are doing just incredible work in relation to the movement for democracy in Haiti. And Leslie spoke about the struggle of immigrants. I'm an immigrant myself. I'm from the Caribbean region. I'm from Barbados. And I'm going to focus, I was asked to focus on solidarity and solidarity with the movement on the ground in Haiti. And I'll have to say, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. It's not a question of either we focus our efforts on the crisis of immigration and refugees, which is happening in Haiti. It's happening around the world as people from the global south, from the Horn of Africa, from Liberia, Syria, et cetera, are making their way to the imperialist powers that have exploited us for so very long. A lot of people say, look, why is the U.S. so interested in Haiti, the powers that be, the so-named core group? And we always like to say that we all owe a great debt to Haiti. Why do we owe a great debt to Haiti? Kafanal, I will make a brief mention to that great Haitian Revolution in 1804 because we know it was historic, but it also was international incident. It set an international standard and that the colonial powers including the United States never got over it. They understood then and they understand now the threat of Haiti, what it meant and could mean today for their imperialist, capitalist and otherwise exploitative regimes. And Haiti led the way for the ending of slavery in the Americas. And I just want to add something to that. Part of why I think back then and now, Haiti is of such special interest to the United States and to the former colonial powers, in addition to the wealth in Haiti, in addition to the cheap labor, particularly in the United States, from Haiti, propping up a number of multinational organizations, that Haiti, because of its history, because of its continued resistance, the movement on the ground in Haiti say today, we are completing our revolution begun in 1804. We're not gonna stop until we have it. They've got that tradition of revolution. It represents hope, it represents unity, for all of us of African descent throughout the diaspora, but not only those of African descent, because Haiti played a role in helping with the liberation, Bolivar with the liberation of Latin America. We can't forget that either. But Haiti also represented hope and unity and the possibility of victory, not only for those of us who were still enslaved at the time of the revolution, but also liberation fighters around the world, full circle back to the continent of Africa, but also in Ireland, in Spain, and other places where there were movements of resistance. So rebellions were inspired by Haiti throughout the United States, also throughout the Caribbean region. The 1811 slave rebellion in the New Orleans territory, one of the largest in the United States. Haitians played a critical role in that as slave masters who had fled from Haiti and took their slaves with them to the United States, Louisiana, New Orleans, et cetera. And guess what? They continue to get together with their brothers and sisters from other parts of the continent and formed revolt. And of course, it greatly expanded the size of the United States. The Louisiana Purchase, a lot of people think it's Louisiana. No, it was 15 states and two Canadian provinces. They basically kicked France out of the region. I can say more about that, but there is no time to do that now. And since the Haitian Revolution, the United States, the Western powers, Kavanaugh talked about how they do this character assassination. They've been doing character assassination for Haitians since the revolution, trying to destroy the legacy of the revolution, including the US-led economic boycott that went on for decades, France being paid, demanding reparations for Haiti. Would you believe that? For the loss of their slave labor and also for the cost of the Revolutionary War. And this continued until something like 1949. So when you see Haiti greatly impoverished and without the infrastructure, the education system that Haitians are fighting for, you'll understand that that money was sucked out of Haiti. Citibank in the United States raided Haitian banks and basically as far, you know, took money from the Haitian, from Haitians. So they've been doing everything they can to keep Haiti impoverished, because Haiti is a bad example for any of us who are oppressed anywhere in the world. Because if you could rise up as enslaved people and you could defeat the most powerful army of its day, and you could continue for all of those years until 2022, continuing to struggle, continuing to stand up, and continuing to refuse oppression, that is a bad example for those of us who might have other ideas and other parts of the world. I quickly now want to go on. I won't say much about the Montana Agreement. That has been spoken about. But I also want to talk about solidarity, actually what I call imperialist solidarity. There are a lot of us in the United States, NGOs in Europe, people who want to do good, right? And, you know, not facing the fact that we live in the belly of the beast. And if we live in the belly of the beast, a lot of the habits, the bad habits of imperialism, of capitalism, impact us as well. It can't be because we're a member of an organization or we spout revolutionary language that means that we are immune from this. And there is a habit of, let's say, organizations in the United States, and I'll be critical. I mean, I clearly am part of the movement for change. So it's also a self-criticism for people on my our side of the aisle, so to speak, who like to select their own leaders, the demands from other countries that they support based on their own politics, not on the demands coming from the grassroots. And I'll say a bit of what this means. You know, a colleague of mine long time ago said, we're all responsible for the points of references we choose. I really do believe that is true to this day. And we see examples of this. For example, in Haiti, you have a sector of people in Haiti who have connections with international NGOs. I'm not gonna start naming names right now, though I could and might in the very near future, right? They have the ear of the international left. They're not accountable to the movement on the street, to the movements of the grassroots. They're not accountable to Lavalas. And they are running around and get the ears of the international left. And then people get very confused about what's going on in Haiti. But it's not only Haiti that we see this. We also see it even within the United States. You know, there's a prevailing view that the job of some of us is to educate the working class. And by that, I don't mean learning and knowing our history, knowing about each other's struggles. Of course, that is important. That kind of education is important. And a lot of it comes from working together. But I mean, who have the mindset that, well, impoverished people really don't know who the enemy is and therefore what they should be doing about it. So it'll take an elite group of us to actually inform and guide them. In the United States, an example of it is the welfare rights movement who demanded cash, direct cash from the government for the work they're doing, taking care of their children, et cetera. And today, even the struggle for the child tax credit and for mothers to get money in their hands. Now, it seems to me that the job of those of us in the movement with the grassroots that are making the demands is to make sure how we're all those mothers, those women, but not only those mothers and women, all of us in the United States, in the global South and around the world, get back the wealth that is stolen from all of us. So, you know, that's a totally different mindset. And as Lavalas was mentioned earlier, Covenant mentioned Lavalas, so did Franz and Pierre. They say we must know about December 16th, 1990. If we are doing solidarity with Haiti, we must know that. Why must we know? Because that represents a high point of the movement when the first democratically elected election happened and former President Aristide was elected. Now, Kavanaugh gave us a really fascinating, interesting history in Haiti. My understanding of Lavalas and President Aristide is that the party itself, Lavalas, I think, means flash flood. It is a popular movement. It's a popular party. It is not a sectarian, it's not a party in the way that we see parties. And actually, the Global Women's Strike, we are non-party affiliate. We're independent of political parties on both the left, mainstream, or whatever. We are autonomous. And it seems to me as though the movement, as it is expressing itself in Haiti today, is autonomous. And that means that some of the political parties are not happy with Lavalas, and they're not happy with President Aristide simply because of that. So Fanny Lavalas, in December of last month, in a declaration, they emphasized the importance for activists and sympathizers of Haiti to understand what December 16th, 1990 represented. And we all know, because that history was given to us before, 6 months after being in power, U.S. and core group, France, Canada, back coup against President Aristide. Why do you think that happened? It took an international movement, and some of those hunger strikes that Leslie mentioned also included pressing for the return of President Aristide, which the United States was forced to do. Upon his return, re-election, again, another coup in 2004. All righty. So we have to really scratch our heads and wonder what all of that is about, and that when we look at the movement that is happening now and what solidarity means for the movement, I want to highlight a few things. The massacres that Leslie mentioned, beginning with La Saline, which has a history going back to the slave days, okay, of resistance. It's a part of the capital of Port-au-Prince, one of the first mass massacres recently of these. Tonton Macoute, the revived Tonton Macoute from the Duvalier era, and Duvalieres are still around, all right, went into La Saline and massacred scores of people. The team from Sojourner Truth, from Pacifica, we were the first international team on the ground in La Saline, along with some people from Haiti Action and the National Lawyers Guild, where we got testimony directly from people who were impacted by this massacre. And we actually have a video about it called Massacres in La Saline. If you go to the Sojourner Truth website, you will be able to see that massacre, to be able to see that testimony, that video, and the HaitiSolidarity.net. They actually have the documentation. Leslie was there, others were there from Haiti Action and the National Lawyers Guild. Why am I mentioning this? Because Leslie is absolutely right. This was an attack by a US-backed regime, okay, on grassroots resistance, yet again on the ground in Haiti. And we were told again and again about the role of somebody called Barbecue, who was a former policeman in Haiti, who came into La Saline, and they're now just attacking Bel Air, another community in Haiti, mercilessly. And some of them came in with police vehicles. They came in with brand new weapons. Guess where they got those? Mm. Slaughtering people, raping women, burning people alive, chopping them up, etc. Well, guess what? This very Barbecue now is trying to reform himself and claim he's some kind of revolutionary, even though he worked very closely with Jovenel Moïse, the disgraced Jovenel Moïse, who was assassinated some time back. And you even have prominent journalists in the United States on the left, some of whom are on Pacifica Radio. I can say this, I'm on Pacifica Radio. You have a journalist like Kim Ives running around with this story about how Barbecue is some kind of revolutionary. How dare he? The COINTELPRO operations going on the ground in Haiti will just blow your mind. Well, not so much blow your mind, you just have to go back to the history of the Black Panther Party and Malcolm X, even Martin Luther King, Chairman Fred Hampton in Chicago, to see how they operate. Well, they are like on steroids in Haiti, okay? So there's all kinds of confusion coming out on the ground. So if you want to know what's going on, you got to go to the right sources. I would very much recommend HaitiSolidarity.net. There's also HaitiProv, which is on Twitter, and that gives also a lot of information. But let us not buy this stuff. I mean, the Montana Accord, I'm not surprised that the powers that be are trying to infiltrate and undermine that. They were behind some bogus conference that happened in Louisiana, I think it was last month, allegedly by the Haiti diaspora, but headed by organizations that hardly anybody heard about. The moderator of it was a former U.S. military general, if you would believe, and they claim that they're going to be selecting the next president of Haiti, that were running around trying to meet with members of the Black Caucus, et cetera. We got to watch out for these kinds of operations, okay? I do want to mention a couple of other examples of movements of solidarity, but in terms of the work of the working group of the Global Women's Strike on Haiti and the strike as a whole, we put our money where our mouth is. That's another thing in the United States we have found, and Walter, you might remember when Africans Arising did that fantastic webinar, I raised that issue, and to the credit of Africans Rising, immediately they said, we got to do something about that, and started getting some money down for funding the grassroots in Haiti. We do that on a monthly basis. We went to the Movement for Black Lives and we raised it with them. And after some time in discussion, the Global Movement of Black Lives did end up making a contribution down to the movement of Haiti via the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. Those of us in the Global Women's Strike, we're one of the few organizations. I know they're individuals. Seth Donnelly, not Connolly, Donnelly's his family and so many others, Walter, people who donate on a regular basis. But in terms of organizations, the Global Women's Strike is one of the few that regularly on a monthly basis sends money down to Haiti. Not because we're rich, we're unfunded, but those of us who are part of our network, we kind of tithe, like you know, you do in church every month. Who could put in $50, who could put in $25? Because we can't talk about solidarity in words only. We have to talk about solidarity in terms of what people on the ground are facing and making sure that the movement has as much as they need to carry on. I do have to say, in wrapping up a bit about the politicians and the political class, beginning in the United States. You know, none of us are fooled by the political class. We know very well who they are. I do have to say that when it comes to Haiti, Congresswoman Maxine Waters has been the clearest, she has been the cleanest, and she has stood with Lavalas. She has defended President Aristide, and they try to make her pay the price because there's some others, newbies in Congress, who frankly don't know sweet F all about Haiti, and try to bypass her and put out various letters to Biden asking him to send money down to this regime in place in Haiti. And the question is, Canada just sent down $50 million. We know that the Haitians need the money. Haiti, the most impoverished place in the Western Hemisphere, but where is that money gonna go? Is it gonna be putting food on the table? Is it gonna be uplifting Haitian grassroots people? Or is it gonna go the way of the money that the Moïse regime and Martelly before him stole with money from Venezuela that was meant for the Haitian grassroots? So we have to raise up these kinds of questions. And a lot of people like to make a special case out of Haiti. And of course, Haiti is a special case. Every place is a special case. Lavalas says every human being is a human being. That's one of their quotes. But we also know that we cannot afford the luxury of not looking at the struggles and the need for solidarity of other people around the world. Many of you have heard about Myanmar, former Burma. Thousands of people have been killed by the military and police in the last 10 months. They've been detained, raped, tortured. And you know, Pierre and Kavanaugh, Franz and others, it reminds me of what I saw in Haiti. There's such a relationship. And I think they learn from each other. They have a kind of a playbook. For example, when they succeeded with the coup against President Aristide, they used that playbook, and that had a play in the coup against Manuel Zelaya in Honduras. So there is now an appeal from Mayor Ma. 90% of the garment workers there are women. They have a campaign that's going on to its credit. Haiti Action signed that campaign. You could go to the Global Women's Strike to get information about that. And one other struggle that I want to highlight and that Haiti Action has also supported, which is India. The farmers in India have had an incredible, incredible strike against that dictator, that friend of Trump, Modi, who is there. It's and they are calling for a general strike across India on the 23rd to 24th of February. The reason I'm raising these other countries is that we know that global capitalism, unlike a lot of us in the movement, they plan internationally. And if we think that we could win in one place and it doesn't have an impact in someplace else, or that what is happening in Haiti isn't impacting what they're doing in Thailand or Burma, we have another thought coming. So we have to really get past ourselves in that way. And I think that, I do have to wrap up that we, think about that term, imperialist solidarity. Think about what that means of standing in solidarity, but not standing with the demands of the grassroots on the ground, and not even knowing the history of December 16th, 1990, and the struggle that happened after that. So I'm glad to be able to be part of this struggle, to be able to share with you the views of those of us in the Global Women's Strike that are working on it, and that all of us have to live what it means to take leadership from the bottom. The Poor People's Campaign, they say, when we lift from the bottom, everybody rises. And in the Americas, that bottom is Haiti in wealth. But when it comes to a tradition of revolution, Haiti is right on up there to the top. And we have a lot that we can learn from Haiti.
Margaret Prescott, thank you so much. Marco Castillo is the Binational Director for Global Change Program. Marco Castillo, you have the floor.
Sure. Thank you very much, Walter, and everyone. Thank you for having me. Thank you for organizing this, putting this important webinar together. I am honored to be here. In the past decade, as Margaret and many of you have already mentioned, Haitians have become part of a growing community in Mexico and Central and the rest of Latin America. Many of them seeking asylum have come to enrich our communities, come to enrich our countries with their lives, their ideas, their immense contributions. Many of them come again as asylum seekers, some trying to reach the US, but many of them trying to stay in the countries like Mexico. The truth is that many of them do not come directly from Haiti. Many of them come after a long journey from Brazil and Chile, where they initially arrived and they faced discrimination, racism, particularly what we saw with the Bolsonaro administration in Brazil was terrible for the people from Haiti. And after that, we've seen growing flow of families from Haiti coming into Mexico. But despite all the immense contributions of the beautiful people of Haiti and the community of Haiti that have come to countries like mine, like Mexico, the truth is that the government has reacted in cahoots, in complicity with the US government, and have created harsh conditions for in general, all asylum seekers and all immigrants in Mexico, but particularly against those from Haiti. Mexico has accepted to take some responsibility, quote unquote, on brothers and sisters from Central America, but has taken no sufficient responsibility when it comes to the people from Haiti, who they are led into the US, and then you already spoke extensively on the deportation, increasing deportation that happens in the US once they make it there. So the truth is that many families from Haiti come to Mexico, and since the southern border face discrimination, face racism, and face violence from local governments, from the federal government, from immigration authorities, and unfortunately also from sectors of Mexican society who have reacted with, again, discrimination and racism against. But despite all this mistreatment, families and immigrants and asylum seekers from Haiti have shown their beautiful hearts, and they have stood together despite mistreatment. They've been shown who they are, and they've created cooperatives. They are working. They are, you know, contributing every day to society. More recently, we saw a large number of asylum seekers from Haiti walking together from the southern border, trying to make it to Mexico City, and on their way, you know, they face immense challenges. They don't have a place to stay. They don't have a shelter. They many times don't have food. We're talking about families, not only adults, but children. We already have, we also have a situation of children separated from their families in Mexico at the southern border in detention centers. We also have children unaccompanied minors, probably many of them kids who came to Mexico from Brazil or Chile without their parents. And so to face this emergency that we're seeing in Mexico, Global Exchange appeal to all of our followers and members and all the U.S. society to help us contributing to create a migrant and refugee emergency fund in the past couple of months. I just put it in the chat. This fund very quickly raised $50,000 that have been distributed directly, again, no overhead, directly to shelters that are supporting immigrants and asylum seekers from Haiti on their journey in Mexico City or in their process of integrating to Mexico. This is not enough. This is just a tiny, tiny, amount. And we would love to see this fund growing, because in the case of Mexico, ID is obviously many times trying to come to the U.S., but the truth is that families from ID, many of them are trying to stay in Mexico, and they need a lot of support to find their way to rebuild their lives. And so that's why we're standing here in solidarity with you, with all the people that are right now on the move, fleeing all this corruption backed by the U.S. and hoping and fighting for a better future for the people of Haiti. And we Mexicans see them as a role model in freedom and revolution. And we believe that we should be united more than ever.
Marco, thank you so much. Someone was asking Professor Jerome about the issue of the impact of climate change on Haiti. That might certainly include what's happened with the recent earthquakes, but also this notion about the wealth of Haiti, the resources of Haiti, and how they're being exploited and being used. I know he's worked around environmental issues, and that may be a question he'd like to address.
From the very beginning, they've always had their hand at the throat of Haiti. One of the reasons is the independence of Haiti in 1804, so that no other country can dare claim to be independent like Haiti did. There is also the fact that Haitians have always used their creativity in the struggle from in many different ways. So it's not only the subterranean wealth that resides under Haiti that is causing the aggressivity towards Haiti, but it's also the fact that Haitian activists who have been terrorized and killed in huge numbers by the Duvalier regime, they have resorted to things like the kidnapping of the American ambassador at one point to demand the release of some of the people who were illegally jailed in the jails of Duvalier. And he thinks that it is not only because of the wealth, it's also because of the systematic way that Haitians try to use new ways to defend themselves in their struggle, and the example that they set for the rest of the world. That's the reason why they have their a hand at the throat of Haitians. So yes, there is wealth in Haiti, and I can address the issue because that's kind of what my one of the organizations that I work with, that I co-founded, does. Haiti has a lot of wealth, gold, iridium, uranium, et cetera, but most importantly, has major resources in terms of possible oil reserves and stuff like that. Now, the geological tectonic plate movement that caused the earthquakes, they are not the one that's under California. And a geologist was explaining the other day, it is because Haiti is at a juncture where there is an accumulation of natural resources. That's also the reason why all those tectonic plates meet in the area of Haiti, and that's why you have those earthquakes. So yes, there is a matter of earthquake in Haiti, but it's not necessarily a environmental impact of the atmosphere warming because of the release of carbon in the atmosphere. It's also because years before that, the tectonic plates had come together and at a juncture in the area where Haiti resides. Now, this is a very abbreviated presentation that I'm making, but I'm saying the issues about global warming are kind of different, and they are real, but they are slightly different. The earthquakes are not a result of global warming, but global warming is definitely impacting Haiti big time and is putting the life of Haitians at risk. The drama that exists in Haiti is that we have a government that is put in power by outside sources and that tries to impoverish Haitians and make it impossible for them to protect themselves from these natural disasters. That's the real drama that exists in Haiti.
Thank you, Professor Jerome. Maybe we want to address the question about best ways to continue to mobilize.
Yeah, in terms of mobilizing solidarity, the Haiti Action Committee, as I mentioned, was formed 30 years ago, basically for a special mission. It was to mobilize and help bring the stories and echo the voices of the grassroots movement from Haiti so that once people know the story, we can look at how best to work together, not only to support the solidarity, the struggle in Haiti, but the struggle in Haiti is tied in with the struggles of people in different parts of the world. And I'll give you a quick example. In the labor, when it comes to labor, for example, Haiti has been kept in a way so that the wages that are paid to Haitian workers is very, very low. And the labor movement in Haiti has been systematically repressed, first using the Haitian military and the Tonton Macoutes, and that continues to today. And the Tonton Macoutes were the brutal militia of Papa Doc Duvalier and Baby Doc Duvalier. And today they continue to operate. What people hear in the press as gangs have been, that's just another name, a euphemism for those forces, those militia forces that are acting in a way that are repressing the population and terrorizing the population. So what we are seeing today, this actually prevents organizations, labor organizations, workers from coming together and being able to address and make their demands very strongly to demand higher wages and work and better working conditions. So that is driving the wages in Haiti and keeping them very, very low. When a business outside of Haiti, they usually use moving to Haiti, maybe not right now because of the crisis that's going on, but they have over the years used the low wages in Haiti and the fact that the governments, the dictatorial governments that have been there, have systematically not enforced environmental laws or any of the laws on the books in Haiti that protect workers, that make a way for the workers that protects the workers, the social security program in Haiti for the workers. And so what happens is it undermines, and I know Margaret had mentioned that, it undermines the bargaining chips that workers, that labor unions in different countries, particularly in the US, can use in their negotiations. So usually they threaten workers, well, we'll move to Haiti, or we'll move to Mexico, or we'll move to this other country, where they actually, these multinationals are financing those dictators, are financing those governments, working in conjunction with these governments to keep repressing the workers and keep the wages low. So that's the thing where it's important that the stories be told, that we understand what's going on there, that labor unions, for example, and other organizations, peasant organizations in different parts of the world, other organizations say to it that unless we cannot allow for any of us to be a weak link in the chain of human progress, because you are only as strong as your weakest link. So it's important that we know the stories on so many other fronts. For example, right now, women are being gang raped in Haiti as part of the campaign of terror that's happening. And it's those so-called gangs who are really death squads of the Haitian government. Those death squads have been created to continue to do the work of terrorizing the population. And so what happens is when they can get away with it in Haiti, then we see them practicing it in other places as well. And they make us accept the fact that this has become part of the norm. And people tend to feel, what can we do? What can we do? No, we need to mobilize. Right now, we need to stand up in solidarity and sit down with Jimmy Cherizier, who's the henchman who's in charge of the G9 Federation of Death Squads in Haiti. And shamefully, the UN has supported him, the United Nations. The head of the UN, Antonio Guterres, had stated and praised the fact that where Jimmy Cherizier's G9 Federation is, that the level of homicides has been reduced. And he made that comment about a year ago. And even though he got a lot of heat for it, they don't say it outwardly anymore, but during this occupation of Haiti, they continue to support these people, and that's why they are so emboldened as to continue relentlessly attacking people in Bel Air and in other communities throughout Haiti. So I'll stop there.
In terms of the climate change question, Kavanaugh is absolutely right in terms of the earthquakes, but we also know, as he has said, that when a natural disaster happens, it's exacerbated, made far times worse by the man-made disaster and the poverty and oppression in a particular place. We do know the strength of the hurricanes, though, definitely related to climate change. And I'm from Barbados. My island is small. We're 14 by 21 miles. We don't have any mountains like they do in Haiti. So during the slave days, we had no place to run but into the sea. And that made Barbados having the distinction of being the only place in the world that we know of that the entire society was based on slavery. It was very, very brutal. And right next to my village, a discovery was made not that long ago of one of the largest slave burial grounds in the Americas, over 600 souls. And we didn't even know growing up. But the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Motley, who's the first woman Prime Minister, she traveled to the climate change conference in Glasgow and made quite a stir, because she spoke for a lot of the global south, a lot of the small islands that are under threat, like mine, for going into the sea, the strength of the hurricanes that have destroyed the Dominica, another island nation that was very much a food basket for much of the Caribbean region. We know Haiti gets hit quite a bit. And she, among others, are leading the charge, demanding resources from the global north, from the core group, the US, Canada, France, and the rest of them, who are the world's greatest polluters, that they need to provide the resources for the global south to really help mitigate some of that damage. And there are a lot of other measures that are being taken. So I just wanted to mention that in relation to the hurricanes. And I did neglect to mention CARICOM, the Caribbean region, which Haiti, by the way, is a member of CARICOM, the island nations. And they have been, a bit too modestly, but really trying to find out what's happening on the ground in Haiti. Of course, the pandemic put a halt to some of what it is they wanted to do. And I do have to mention that Congresswoman Karen Bass was another one who, when she was head of the Congressional Black Caucus, who also wrote to CARICOM about concerns in relation to Haiti. But of course, Congresswoman Maxine Waters is always on the lead of these kinds of efforts. The last point that I wanted to quickly make in terms of solidarity, and Ustadi, I love your presentation with what you can do. The students, I want a t-shirt, but also just in terms of people, if you are not donating now for Haiti, please, the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, I'm sure somebody could put that link in the chat, is a place that you can do, you personally, or if your organization has not making a donation, even if you can't do it every month, like we in the Global Women's Strike do, you know, quarterly or whatever it is that you can do. But specifically, I wanted to mention UNIFA, which is the hospital of the Addis Dee Foundation. They have done amazing work during that 2004 coup. It was a medical school then, and it was shut down, and the US Marines used it as a barracks. When President Addis Dee returned, and Madame Addis Dee, President Addis Dee said he wanted to focus on education. A lot of people didn't understand why he was doing that. But if you look at the work of the UNIFA right now, you will see exactly what he means. I've been to several graduations, and you know, to see thousands of these students and their families pledging. The students, when they graduate, they pledge to make a commitment for the movement, for the people, to go and work with the people, as opposed to only servicing the doctors and the lawyers, et cetera, who graduate serving the 1%. They're now in process of building a hospital, a teaching hospital on the campus. It needs support, it needs money, but any of you who are in the academy, any of you who are students or professors in the university out there, they very much encourage exchanges and support. So I'm sure if we put the link for some, if someone could do that for the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, it's not only a question of donating, but it's a question of any skills that you might have or expertise in any particular field. I've got a medical school, a law school, a nursing school, physical therapy, agronomy is the latest. And it's just fantastic work that they're doing, giving hope to the young people in Haiti. And they also are out in the community with a free medical care clinics. They've got a dental school.